Chapter 7. So the chief burned and the president walked. As far as C Block, anyway, which was home to most of Cold Mountain's 150 lifers. Life for the Prez turned out to be 12 years. He was drowned in the prison laundry in 1944. Not the Cold Mountain prison laundry. Cold Mountain closed in 1933. I don't suppose it mattered much to the inmates. Walls is walls, as the cons say. And old Sparky was every bit as lethal in his own little stone death chamber, I reckon, as he'd ever been in the storage room at Cold Mountain. As for the Prez, someone shoved him face first into a vat of dry cleaning fluid and held him there. When the guards pulled him out again, his face was almost entirely gone. They had to ID him by his fingerprints. On the whole, he might have been better off with old Sparky. But then he never would have had those extra 12 years, would he? I doubt he thought much about them, though, in the last minute or so of his life, when his lungs were trying to learn how to breathe hexlight and lye cleanser. They never caught whoever did for him. By then I was long out of the corrections line of work, but Harry Terwilliger wrote and told me. He didn't get it like the chief and Delacroix and Coffee because he was white, Harry wrote, but he got it in the end just the same. I just think of it as a long stay of execution that finally ran out. There was a quiet time for us in E Block once the Prez was gone. Harry and Dean were temporarily reassigned, and it was just me, Brutal, and Percy on the Green Mile for a little bit. Which actually meant just me and Brutal, because Percy kept pretty much to himself. I tell you, that young man was a genius at finding things not to do. And every so often, but only when Percy wasn't around, the other guys would show up to have what Harry liked to call a good gab. On many of these occasions, the mouse would also show up. We'd feed him, and he'd sit there eating, just as solemn as Solomon, watching us with his bright little oil-spot eyes. That was a good few weeks, calm and easy, even with Percy's more than occasional carping. But all good things come to an end. And on a rainy Monday in late July, have I told you how rainy and dank that summer was? I found myself sitting on the bunk of an open cell and waiting for Edouard Delacroix. He came with an unexpected bang. The door leading into the exercise yard slammed open, letting in a flood of light. There was a confused rattle of chains, a frightened voice babbling away in a mixture of English and Cajun French, a patois the cons at Cold Mountain used to call the Bayou, and Brutal hollering, "Hey, quit it! For Christ's sakes, quit it, Percy!" I had been half-dozing on what was to become Delacroix's bunk, but I was up in a hurry, my heart slugging away hard in my chest. Noise of that kind on E-Block almost never happened until Percy came. He brought it along with him like a bad smell. "Come on, you fucking French fried faggot!" Percy yelled, ignoring Brutal completely. And here he came, dragging a guy not much bigger than a bowling pin by one arm. In his other hand, Percy had his baton. His teeth were bared in a strained grimace, and his face was bright red. Yet he did not look entirely unhappy. Delacroix was trying to keep up with him, but he had the leg irons on, and no matter how fast he shuffled his feet, Percy pulled him along faster. I sprang out of the cell just in time to catch him as he fell, and that was how Del and I were introduced. Percy rounded on him, baton raised, and I held him back with one arm. Brutal came puffing up to us, looking as shocked and nonplussed by all this as I felt.
"Don't let him hit me no more, monsieur," Delacroix babbled. "S'il vous plaît, s'il vous plaît."
"Let me at him, let me at him,"
Percy cried, lunging forward. He began to hit at Delacroix's shoulders with his baton. Delacroix held his arms up, screaming, and the stick went whap, whap, whap against the sleeves of his blue prison shirt. I saw him that night with the shirt off, and that boy had bruises from Christmas to Easter. Seeing them made me feel bad. He was a murderer and nobody's darling, but that's not the way we did things on E-Block. Not until Percy came, anyhow.
"Whoa, whoa," I roared. "Quit that! What's it all about, anyway?"
I was trying to get my body in between Delacroix and Percy, but it wasn't working very well. Percy's club continued to flail away, now on one side of me and now on the other.
Sooner or later, he was going to bring one down on me instead of on his intended target, and then there was going to be a brawl right here in this corridor, no matter who his relations were. I wouldn't be able to help myself, and Brutal was apt to join in. In some ways, you know, I wish we'd done it. It might have changed some of the things that happened later on.
Fucking faggot! I'll teach you to keep your hands off me, you lousy bum-puncher!
Whap, whap, whap. And now Delacroix was bleeding from one ear and screaming. I gave up trying to shield him, grabbed him by one shoulder, and hurled him into his cell, where he went sprawling on the bunk. Percy darted around me and gave him a final hard whap on the butt, one to go on, you could say. Then Brutal grabbed him, Percy, I mean, by the shoulders, and hauled him across the corridor. I grabbed the cell door and ran it shut on its tracks. Then I turned to Percy, my shock and bewilderment at war with pure fury. Percy had been around about 4 months at that point, long enough for all of us to decide we didn't like him very much. But that was the first time I fully understood how out of control he was. He stood watching me, not entirely without fear. He was a coward at heart, I never had any doubt of that, but still confident that his connections would protect him. In that he was correct. I suspect there are people who wouldn't understand why that was, even after all I've said. But they would be people who only know the phrase Great Depression from the history books. If you were there, it was a lot more than a phrase in a book, and if you had a steady job, brother, you'd do almost anything to keep it. The color was fading out of Percy's face a little by then, but his cheeks were still flushed, and his hair, which was usually swept back and gleaming with brilliantine, had tumbled over his forehead.
"What in the Christ was that all about?" I asked. I have never had a prisoner beaten onto my block before.
"Little fag bastard tried to count my joint when I pulled him out of the van," Percy said. "He had it coming, and I'd do it again."
I looked at him, too flabbergasted for words. I couldn't imagine the most predatory homosexual on God's green earth doing what Percy had just described. Preparing to move into a crossbar apartment on the Green Mile did not, as a rule, put even the most deviant of prisoners in a sexy mood. I looked back at Delacroix, cowering on his bunk with his arms still up to protect his face. There were cuffs on his wrists and a chain running between his ankles. Then I turned to Percy.
"Get out of here," I said. "I want to talk to you later."
"Is this going to be in your report?" he demanded truculently, "because if it is, I can make a report of my own, you know."
I didn't want to make a report. I only wanted him out of my sight. I told him so. "The matter's closed," I finished. I saw Brutal looking at me disapprovingly, but ignored it.
"Go on, get out of here. Go over to admin and tell him you're supposed to read letters and help in the package room."
"Sure." He had his composure back, or the crack-headed arrogance that served him as composure. He brushed his hair back from his forehead with his hands, soft and white and small, the hands of a girl in her early teens, you would have thought, and then approached the cell. Delacroix saw him, and he cringed back even further on his bunk, gibbering in a mixture of English and stewpot French.
"I ain't done with you, Pierre," he said,
then jumped as one of Brutal's huge hands fell on his shoulder.
"Yes, you are," Brutal said. "Now go on, get in the breeze."
"You don't scare me, you know," Percy said. "Not a bit."
His eyes shifted to me.
"Either of you."
But we did. You could see that in his eyes as clear as day, and it made him even more dangerous. A guy like Percy doesn't even know himself what he means to do from minute to minute and second to second. What he did right then was turn away from us and go walking up the corridor in long, arrogant strides. He had shown the world what happened when scrawny, half-bald little Frenchman tried to cop his joint, by God, and he was leaving the field a victor. I went through my set speech all about how we had the radio, make-believe ballroom, and our gal Sunday most nights, and how we'd treat him Jake if he did the same for us. That little homily was not what you'd call one of my great successes. He cried all the way through it, sitting huddled up at the foot of his bunk, as far from me as he could get without actually fading into the corner.
He cringed every time I moved, and I don't think he heard one word in six. Probably just as well. I don't think that particular homily made a whole lot of sense anyway. 15 minutes later, I was back at the desk, where a shaken-looking Brutus Howell was sitting and licking the tip of the pencil we kept with the visitor's book. "Will you stop that before you poison yourself, for God's sake?" I asked. "Christ Almighty Jesus," he said, putting the pencil down. "I never want to have another hoorah like that with a prisoner coming on the block." "My daddy always used to say things come in threes," I said. "Well, I hope your daddy was full of shit on that subject," Brutal said. But of course he wasn't. There was a squall when John Coffey came in, and a full-blown storm when Wild Bill joined us. It's funny, but things really do seem to come in threes. The story of our introduction to Wild Bill, how he came onto the mile trying to commit murder, is something I'll get to shortly. Fair warning. "What's this about Delacroix copping his joint?" I asked. Brutal snorted. "He was ankle-chained, and old Percy was just pulling him too fast, that's all. He stumbled and started to fall as he got out of the stagecoach. He put his hands out, same as anyone would when they start to fall, and one of them brushed the front of Percy's pants. It was a complete accident." "Did Percy know that, do you think?" I asked. "Was he maybe using it as an excuse, just because he felt like wailing on Delacroix a little bit, showing him who bosses the shooting match around here?" Brutal nodded slowly. "Yeah, I think that was probably it." "We have to watch him, then," I said, and ran my hands through my hair, as if the job wasn't hard enough. "God, I hate this. I hate him."
"Me too.
And you want to know something else, Paul?
I don't understand him. He's got connections, I understand that, all right, but why would he use them to get a job on the Green fucking Mile? Anywhere in the state pen, for that matter. Why not as a page in the state senate, or the guy who makes the lieutenant governor's appointments? Surely his people could have gotten him something better if he'd asked them, so why here?"
I shook my head. I didn't know. There were a lot of things I didn't know then. I suppose I was naive. Chapter 8. After that, things went back to normal again, for a while, at least. Down in the county seat, the state was preparing to bring John Coffey to trial as soon as they could, and Trepingas County Sheriff Homer Kribus was poo-pooing the idea that a lynch mob might hurry justice along a little bit. None of that mattered to us. On E Block, no one paid much attention to the news. Life on the Green Mile was, in a way, like life in a soundproof room. From time to time you heard mutterings that were probably explosions in the outside world, but that was about all. They wouldn't hurry with John Coffey. They'd want to make damned sure of him. On a couple of occasions, Percy got to ragging Delacroix, and the second time I pulled him aside and told him to come up to my office. It wasn't my first interview with Percy on the subject of his behavior, and it wouldn't be the last, but it was prompted by what was probably the clearest understanding of what he was. He had the heart of a cruel boy who goes to the zoo not so he can study the animals, but so he can throw stones at them in their cages. "You stay away from him now, you hear?" I said. "Unless I give you a specific order, just stay the hell away from him." Percy combed his hair back, then patted at it with his sweet little hands. That boy just loved touching his hair.
"I wasn't doing nothing to him," he said. "Only asking how it felt to know you'd burned up some babies is all."
Percy gave me a round-eyed, innocent stare. "You quit with it, or there'll be a report," I said. He laughed.
"Make any report you want," he said. "Then I'll turn around and make my own, just like I told you when he came in. We'll see who comes off the best."
I leaned forward, hands folded on my desk, and spoke in a tone I hoped would sound like a friend being confidential. "Brutus Howell doesn't like you much," I said, and when Brutal doesn't like someone, he's been known to make his own report. He isn't much shakes with a pen, and he can't quit from licking that pencil, so he's apt to report with his fists, if you know what I mean. Percy's complacent little smile faltered.
What are you trying to say?
I'm not trying to say anything. I have said it. And if you tell any of your friends about this discussion, I'll say you made the whole thing up. I looked at him all wide-eyed and earnest. Besides, I'm trying to be your friend, Percy. A word to the wise is sufficient, they say. And why would you want to get into it with Delacroix in the first place? He's not worth it. And for a while that worked. There was peace. A couple of times I was even able to send Percy with Dean or Harry when Delacroix's time to shower had rolled around. We had the radio at night. Delacroix began to relax a little into the scant routine of E-Block. And there was peace. Then one night I heard him laughing. Harry Terwilliger was on the desk, and soon he was laughing too. I got up and went on down to Delacroix's cell to see what he possibly had to laugh about.
"Look, Captain," he said when he saw me. "I don't tame me a mouse."
It was Steamboat Willie. He was in Delacroix's cell. More, he was sitting on Delacroix's shoulder and looking calmly out through the bars at us with his little oil-drop eyes. His tail was curled around his paws, and he looked completely at peace. As for Delacroix, friend, you wouldn't have known it was the same man who'd sat cringing and shuddering at the foot of his bunk not a week before. He looked like my daughter used to on Christmas morning when she came down the stairs and saw the presents.
"Watch this,"
Delacroix said. The mouse was sitting on his right shoulder. Delacroix stretched out his left arm. The mouse scampered up to the top of Delacroix's head, using the man's hair, which was thick enough in back at least, to climb up. Then he scampered down the other side, Delacroix giggling as his tail tickled the side of his neck. The mouse ran all the way down his arm to his wrist, then turned, scampered back up to Delacroix's left shoulder, and curled his tail around his feet again.
"I'll be damned," Harry said. "I train him to do that,"
Delacroix said proudly. I thought, "In a pig's ass you did," but kept my mouth shut.
"His name is Mr. Jingles."
"No," Harry said good-naturedly. "It's Steamboat Willie, like in the picture show. Boss Howell named him."
"It's Mr. Jingles," Delacroix said.
On any other subject, he would have told you that shit was Shinola if you wanted him to, but on the subject of the mouse's name, he was perfectly adamant.
"He whispered it in my ear. Cap'n, can I have a box for him? Can I have a box for my mouse so he can sleep in here with me?"
His voice began to fall into wheedling tones I had heard 1,000 times before.
"I put him under my bunk, and he never be a screed of trouble, not one."
"Your English gets a hell of a lot better when you want something," I said, stalling for time.
"Uh-oh," Harry murmured, nudging me. "Here comes trouble."
But Percy didn't look like trouble to me, not that night. He wasn't running his hands through his hair or fiddling with that baton of his, and the top button of his uniform shirt was actually undone. It was the first time I'd seen him that way, and it was amazing what a change a little thing like that could make. Mostly, though, what struck me was the expression on his face. There was a calmness there. Not serenity. I don't think Percy Wetmore had a serene bone in his body, but the look of a man who has discovered he can wait for the things he wants. It was quite a change from the young man I'd had to threaten with Brutus Howell's fists only a few days before, I can tell you that. Delacroix didn't see the change, though. He cringed against the wall of his cell, drawing his knees up to his chest. His eyes seemed to grow until they were taking up half his face. The mouse scampered up on his bald pate and sat there. I don't know if he remembered that he also had reason to distrust Percy, but it certainly looked as if he did. Probably it was just smelling the little Frenchman's fear and reacting off that.
"Well, well," Percy said. "Looks like you found yourself a friend, Eddie."
Delacroix tried to reply, some hollow defiance about what would happen to Percy if Percy heard his new pal, would have been my guess, but nothing came out. His lower lip trembled a little, but that was all. On top of his head, Mr. Jingles wasn't trembling. He sat perfectly still, with his back feet in Delacroix's hair and his front ones splayed on Delacroix's bald skull, looking at Percy, seeming to size him up, the way you'd size up an old enemy. Percy looked at me.
"Isn't that the same one I chased? The one that lives in the restraint room?"
I nodded. I had an idea Percy hadn't seen the newly named Mr. Jingles since that last chase, and he showed no signs of wanting to chase it now. "Yes, that's the one," I said. "Only Delacroix there says his name is Mr. Jingles, not Steamboat Willie. Says the mouse whispered it in his ear."
"Is that so?" Percy said. "Wonders never cease, do they?"
I half expected him to pull out his baton and start tapping it against the bars just to show Delacroix who was boss, but he only stood there with his hands on his hips looking in. And for no reason I could have told you in words, I said, "Delacroix there was just asking for a box, Percy. He thinks that mouse'll sleep in it, I guess, that he can keep it for a pet." I loaded my voice with skepticism and sensed more than saw Harry looking at me in surprise. "What do you think about that?"
"I think it'll probably shit up his nose some night while he's sleeping and then run away," Percy said evenly. "But I guess that's a French boy's lookout. I seen a pretty nice cigar box on Toot Toot's cart the other night. I don't know if he'd give it away, though. Probably want a nickel for it, maybe even a dime."
Now I did risk a glance at Harry and saw his mouth hanging open. This wasn't quite like the change in Ebenezer Scrooge on Christmas morning after the ghosts had had their way with him, but it was damned close. Percy leaned closer to Delacroix, putting his face between the bars. Delacroix shrank back even further. I swear to God that he would have melted into that wall if he'd been able.
"You got a nickel, or maybe as much as a dime to pay for a cigar box, you lagoon?" he asked. "I got 4 pennies, Delacroix said. "I give damn for a box if he's a good one, c'est le bon."
"I tell you what," Percy said. "If that toothless old whoremaster will sell you that Corona box for 4 cents, I'll sneak some cotton batting out of the dispensary to line it with. We'll make us a regular mousy Hilton before we're through." He switched his eyes to me. "I'm supposed to write a switchroom report about Bitterbuck," he said. "Is there some pens in your office, Paul?" "Yes, indeed," I said. "Forms, too, left-hand top drawer."
"Well, that's aces," he said, and went swaggering off.
Harry and I looked at each other.
"Is he sick, you think?" Harry asked. "Maybe went to his doctor and found out he's only got 3 months to live?"
I told him I didn't have the slightest idea what was up. It was the truth then, and for a while after, but I found out in time. And a few years later I had an interesting supper table conversation with Hal Moores. By then we could talk freely, what with him being retired and me being at the boys' correctional. It was one of those meals where you drink too much and eat too little and tongues get loosened. Hal told me that Percy had been in to complain about me and about life on the mile in general. This was just after Delacroix came on the block and Brutal and I had kept Percy from beating him half to death. What had griped Percy the most was me telling him to get out of my sight. He didn't think a man who was related to the governor should have to put up with talk like that. Well, Moores told me, he had stood Percy off for as long as he could. And when it became clear to him that Percy was going to try pulling some strings to get me reprimanded and moved to another part of the prison at the very least, he, Moores, had pulled Percy into his office and told him that if he quit rocking the boat, Moores would make sure that Percy was out front for Delacroix's execution, that he would, in fact, be placed right beside the chair. I would be in charge, as always, but the witnesses wouldn't know that. To them it would look as if Mr. Percy Wetmore was boss of the cotillion. Moores wasn't promising any more than what we'd already discussed, and I'd agreed to, but Percy didn't know that. He agreed to leave off his threats to have me reassigned, and the atmosphere on E Block sweetened. He had even agreed that Delacroix could keep Percy's old nemesis as a pet. It's amazing how some men can change, given the right incentive. In Percy's case, all Warden Moores had to offer was the chance to take a bald little Frenchman's life. Chapter 9. Toot Toot felt that 4 cents was far too little for a prime Corona cigar box, and in that he was probably right. Cigar boxes were highly prized objects in prison. 1,000 different small items could be stored in them, the smell was pleasant, and there was something about them that reminded our customers of what it was like to be free men. Because cigarettes were permitted in prison, but cigars were not, I imagine. Dean Stanton, who was back on the block by then, added a penny to the pot, and I kicked one in as well. When Toot still proved reluctant, Brutal went to work on him, first telling him he ought to be ashamed of himself for behaving like such a cheapskate, then promising him that he, Brutus Howell, would personally put that Corona box back in Toot's hands the day after Delacroix's execution. 6 cents might or might not be enough if he was speaking about selling that cigar box. We could have a good old barbershop argument about that, Brutal said. But you have to admit it's a great price for renting one. He's going to walk the mile in a month, 6 weeks at the very outside. Why, that box will be back on your shelf under your cot almost before you know it's gone.
He could get his soft-hearted judge to give him a stay and still be here to sing Should Old Acquaintances Be Forgot, Toot said.
But he knew better, and Brutal knew he did. Old Toot Toot had been pushing that damned Bible-quoting cart of his around Cold Mountain since Pony Express days, practically, and he had plenty of sources. Better than ours, I thought then. He knew Delacroix was fresh out of soft-hearted judges. All he had left to hope for was the governor, who, as a rule, didn't issue clemency to folks who had baked half a dozen of his constituents.
"'Even if he don't get his stay, that mouse would be shitting in that box until October, maybe even Thanksgiving,' Toot argued.
But Brutal could see he was weakening.
"'Who gonna buy a cigar box some mouse been using for a toilet?'
"'Oh, jeez Louise,' Brutal said. "'That's the numbest thing I ever heard you say, Toot. I mean, that takes the cake. First, Delacroix will keep the box clean enough to eat a church dinner out of. The way he loves that mouse, he'd lick it clean if that's what it took.'
"'Easy on that stuff,' Toot said, wrinkling his nose.
"'Second,' Brutal went on, "'mouse shit is no big deal anyway. "'It's just hard little pellets. "'Looks like birdshot. "'Shake it right out. "'Nothing to it.'
Old Toot knew better than to carry his protest any further. He'd been on the yard long enough to understand when he could afford to face into the breeze and when he'd do better to bend in the hurricane. This wasn't exactly a hurricane, but we blue suits liked the mouse, and we liked the idea of Delacroix having the mouse, and that meant it was at least a gale. So Delacroix got his box, and Percy was as good as his word. 2 days later, the bottom was lined with soft pads of cotton batting from the dispensary. Percy handed them over himself, and I could see the fear in Delacroix's eyes as he reached out through the bars to take them. He was afraid Percy would grab his hand and break his fingers. I was a little afraid of it, too, but no such thing happened. That was the closest I ever came to liking Percy, but even then it was hard to mistake the look of cool amusement in his eyes. Delacroix had a pet, Percy had one, too. Delacroix would keep his, petting it and loving it as long as he could. Percy would wait patiently as a man like him could anyway, and then burn his alive.
"'Massey Hilton open for business,' Harry said. "'The only question is, will a little bugger use it?'
That question was answered as soon as Delacroix caught Mr. Jingles up in one hand and lowered him gently into the box. The mouse snuggled into the white cotton as if it were Aunt Bee's comforter, and that was his home from then until... Well, I'll get to the end of Mr. Jingle's story pretty directly. Old Toot Toot's worries that the cigar box would fill up with mouse shit proved to be entirely groundless. I never saw a single turd in there, and Delacroix said he never did either, anywhere in his cell, for that matter. Much later, around the time Brutal showed me the hole in the beam and we found the colored splinters, I moved a chair out of the restraint room's east corner and found a little pile of mouse turds back there. He had always gone back to the same place to do his business, seemingly, and as far from us as he could get. Here's another thing. I never saw him peeing. And usually mice can hardly turn the faucet off for 2 minutes at a time, especially while they're eating. I told you the damn thing was one of God's mysteries. A week or so after Mr. Jingles had settled into the cigar box, Delacroix called me and Brutal down to his cell to see something. He did that so much it was annoying. If Mr. Jingles so much as rolled over on his back with his paws in the air, it was the cutest thing on God's earth as far as that half-pint Cajun was concerned. But this time what he was up to really was sort of amusing. Delacroix had been pretty much forgotten by the world following his conviction, but he had one relation, an old maiden aunt, I believe, who wrote him once a week. She had also sent him an enormous bag of peppermint candies, a sort which are marketed under the name Canada Mints these days. They looked like big pink pills. Delacroix was not allowed to have the whole bag at once, naturally. It was a 5-pounder, and he would have gobbled them until he had to go to the infirmary with stomach gripes. Like almost every murderer we ever had on the Mile, he had absolutely no understanding of moderation. We'd give them out to him half a dozen at a time, and only then if he remembered to ask. Mr. Jingles was sitting beside Delacroix on the bunk when we got down there, holding one of those pink candies in his paws and munching contentedly away at it. Delacroix was simply overcome with delight. He was like a classical pianist watching his 5-year-old son play his first halting classical passages. But don't get me wrong, it was funny. A real hoot. The candy was half the size of Mr. Jingles, and his white-furred belly was already distended from it. "Take it away from him, Eddie," Brutal said, half laughing and half horrified. "Christ almighty Jesus, he'll eat till he busts. I can smell that peppermint from here. How many have you let him have?" "This his second," Delacroix said, looking a little nervously at Mr. Jingles' belly. "You really think he, you know, boss his guts?" "Might," Brutal said. That was enough authority for Delacroix. He reached for the half-eaten pink mint. I expected the mouse to nip him, but it gave over that mint, what remained of it anyway, as meek as could be. I looked at Brutal, and Brutal gave his head a little shake, as if to say no, he didn't understand it either. Then Mr. Jingles plopped down into his box and lay there on his side in an exhausted way that made all three of us laugh. After that, we got used to seeing the mouse sitting beside Delacroix, holding a mint and munching away on it just as neatly as an old lady at an afternoon tea party, both of them surrounded by what I later smelled in that hole in the beam, a half-bitter, half-sweet smell of peppermint candy.